best he could. The two children the policeman had told him had vanished from the Oxfordshire area 20 years previously. Wardle had misspelled the boy's first name, which had cost Strike time. But Strike had finally dug out archived press reports about Imamu Ibrahim, in which Imamu's mother had asserted that her estranged husband had kidnapped the boy and taken him to Algeria. Strike had finally dredged up two lines about Imamu and his mother on the website of an organisation that worked to resolve international custody issues. From this, Strike had to conclude that Imamu had been found alive and well with his father. The fate of Suki Lewis, the 12-year-old runaway from a care home, was more mysterious. Strike had finally discovered an image of her buried in an old news story. Suki had vanished from her residential care home in Swindon in 1992, and Strike could find no other mention of her since. Her blurry picture showed a rather toothy, undersized child, fine-featured, with short, dark hair. Little girl it was, but after they said it was a little boy. So a vulnerable, androgynous child might have disappeared off the face of the earth around the same time, and in the approximate area that Billy Knight claimed to have witnessed the strangling of a boy-girl. In the car, he composed a text to Robin. If you can make it sound natural, ask Izzy if she remembers anything about a 12-year-old called Suki Lewis. She ran away 20 years ago from a care home near their family house. The dirt on his windscreen shimmered and blurred in the rising sun as he left London. Driving was no longer the pleasure it had once been. Strike could not afford a specially adapted vehicle, and even though it was an automatic, the operation of the BMW's pedals remained challenging with his prosthesis. In challenging conditions, he sometimes reverted to operating brake and accelerator with his left foot. When he finally joined the M6, Strike hoped to settle in at 60 miles an hour, but some arsehole in a Vauxhall Corsa decided to tailgate him.
"Fucking overtake," growled Strike.
He was not minded to alter his own speed. Having settled in comfortably, without needing to use his false foot more than was necessary, and for a while he glowered into his rear-view mirror until the Vauxhall driver got the hint and took himself off. Relaxing to the degree that was ever possible behind the wheel these days, Strike wound down the window to admit the fine, fresh summer's day, and allowed his thoughts to return to Billy and the missing Suki Lewis.
"She wouldn't let me dig," he had said in the office,
compulsively tapping his nose and his chest.
"But she'd let you."
Who, Strike wondered, was she? Perhaps the new owner of Stedder Cottage. They might well object to Billy asking to dig up flowerbeds in search of bodies. After feeling around with his left hand inside his provisions bag, extracting and ripping open a bag of crisps with his teeth, Strike reminded himself for the umpteenth time that Billy's whole story might be a chimera. Suki Lewis could be anywhere. Not every lost child was dead. Perhaps Suki too had been stolen away by an errant parent. 20 years previously, in the infancy of the internet, imperfect communication between regional police forces could be exploited by those wishing to reinvent themselves or others. And even if Suki was no longer alive, there was nothing to suggest that she had been strangled, let alone that Billy Knight had witnessed it. Most people would surely conclude that this was a case of much smoke, but no fire. Chewing crisps by the handful, Strike reflected that whenever it came to a question of what most people would think, he usually envisaged his half-sister Lucy, the only one of his 7 half-siblings with whom he had shared his chaotic and peripatetic childhood. To him, Lucy represented the acme of all that was conventional and unimaginative, even though they had both grown up on intimate terms with the macabre, the dangerous, and the frightening. Before Lucy had gone to live permanently with their aunt and uncle in Cornwall at the age of 14, their mother had hauled her and Strike from squat to commune to rented flat to friend's floor, rarely remaining in the same place more than 6 months, exposing her children to a parade of eccentric, damaged and addicted human beings along the way. Right hand on the wheel, left hand now groping around for biscuits, Strike recalled some of the nightmarish spectacles that he and Lucy had witnessed as children. The psychotic youth fighting an invisible devil in a basement flat in Shoreditch. The teenager literally being whipped at a quasi-mystical commune in Norfolk. Still, for Strike's money, the worst place that Leda had ever taken them. And Shayla, one of the most fragile of Leda's friends and a part-time prostitute, sobbing about the brain damage inflicted on her toddler son by a violent boyfriend. The unpredictable and sometimes terrifying childhood had left Lucy with a craving for stability and conformity. Married to a quantity surveyor whom Strike disliked, with three sons he barely knew, she would probably dismiss Billy's story of the strangled boy-girl as the product of a broken mind, sweeping it swiftly away into the corner with all the other things she could not bear to think about. Lucy needed to pretend that violence and strangeness had vanished into a past as dead as their mother, that with Leda gone, life was unshakably secure. Strike understood. Profoundly different though they were, often though she exasperated him, he loved Lucy. Nevertheless, he could not help comparing her with Robin as he bowled towards Manchester. Robin had grown up in what seemed to Strike the very epitome of middle-class stability, but she was courageous in a way that Lucy was not. Both women had been touched by violence and sadism. Lucy had reacted by burying herself where she hoped it would never reach her again. Robin, by facing it almost daily, investigating and resolving other crimes and traumas, driven to do so by the same impulse to actively disentangle complications and disinter truths that Strike recognized in himself. As the sun climbed higher, still dappling the grubby windscreen, he experienced a powerful regret that she wasn't here with him now. She was the best person he had ever met to run a theory past. She'd unscrew the thermos for him and pour him tea. We'd have a laugh. They had slipped back into their old bantering ways a couple of times lately, since Billy had entered the office with a story troubling enough to break down the reserve that had, over a year, hardened into a permanent impediment to their friendship. Or whatever it was, thought Strike. And for a moment or two, he felt her again in his arms on the stairs, breathed in the scent of white roses and of the perfume that hung around the office when Robin was at her desk. With a kind of mental grimace, he reached for another cigarette, lit up, and forced his mind towards Manchester and the line of questioning he intended to take with Dawn Clancy, who, for 5 years, had been Mrs. Jimmy Knight. Chapter 15. Yes, she is a queer one, she is. She has always been very much on the high horse. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. While Strike was speeding northwards, Robin was summoned without explanation to a personal meeting with the Minister for Culture himself. Walking in the sunshine towards the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which stood in a large white Edwardian building a few minutes away from the Palace of Westminster, Robin found herself almost wishing that she were one of the tourists cluttering the pavement, because Chisel had sounded bad-tempered on the phone. Robin would have given a great deal to have something useful to tell the minister about his blackmailer, but as she had only been on the job a day and a half, all she could say with any certainty was that her first impressions of Geraint Wynne had now been confirmed. He was lazy, lecherous, self-important, and indiscreet. The door of his office stood open more often than not, and his sing-song voice rang down the corridor as he talked with injudicious levity about his constituents' petty concerns, name-dropped celebrities and senior politicians, and generally sought to give the impression of a man for whom running a mere constituency office was an unimportant sideshow. He hailed Robin jovially from his desk whenever she passed his open door, showing a pronounced eagerness for further contact. However, whether by chance or design, Amir Malik kept thwarting Robin's attempts to turn these greetings into conversations, either interrupting with questions for Wynne, or, as he had done just an hour previously, simply closing the door in Robin's face. The exterior of the great block that housed the DCMS, with its stone swags, its columns, and its neoclassical facade, was not reassuring. The interior had been modernized and hung with contemporary art, including an abstract glass sculpture that hung from the cupola over the central staircase, up which Robin was led by an efficient-seeming young woman. Believing her to be the minister's goddaughter, her companion was at pains to show her points of interest. "The Churchill Room," she said, pointing left as they turned right. "That's the balcony he gave his speech from on VE Day. The minister's just along here." She led Robin down a wide, curving corridor that doubled as an open-plan workspace. Smart young people sat at an array of desks in front of lengthy windows to the right, which looked out onto a quadrangle which, in size and scale, bore the appearance of a colosseum with its high white windowed walls. It was all very different from the cramped office where Izzy made their instant coffee from a kettle. Indeed, a large, expensive machine complete with pods sat on one desk for the purpose. The offices to the left were separated from this curving space by glass walls and doors. Robin spotted the Minister for Culture from a distance, sitting at his desk beneath a contemporary painting of the Queen, talking on the telephone. He indicated by a brusque gesture that her escort should show Robin inside the office and continued talking on the telephone as Robin waited, somewhat awkwardly, for him to finish his call. A woman's voice was issuing from the earpiece, high-pitched and to Robin, even 8 feet away, hysterical.
"I've got to go, Kinvara," barked Chisel into the mouthpiece. "Yes, we'll talk about this later. I've got to go."
Setting down the receiver harder than was necessary, he pointed Robin to a chair opposite him. His coarse, straight grey hair stood out around his head in a wiry halo, his fat lower lip giving him an air of angry petulance.
"The newspapers are sniffing around," he growled. "That was my wife. The Sun rang her this morning asking whether the rumours are true. She said what rumours, but the fellow didn't specify. Fishing, obviously. Trying to surprise something out of her."
He frowned at Robin, whose appearance he seemed to find wanting.
"How old are you?"
27, she said.
"You look younger."
It didn't sound like a compliment.
"Managed to plant the surveillance device yet?"
"I'm afraid not," said Robin.
"Where's Strike?"
"In Manchester, interviewing Jimmy Knight's ex-wife," said Robin. Chisel made the angry subterranean noise usually rendered as harumph, then got to his feet. Robin jumped up too.
"Well, you better get back and get on with it," said Chisel. "The National Health Service," he added, with no change of tone, as he headed towards the door. "People are going to think we're bloody mad."
"Sorry," said Robin, entirely thrown. Chisel pulled open the glass door and indicated that Robin should pass through it ahead of him, out into the open plan area, where all the smart young people sat working beside their sleek coffee machine.
"Olympics opening ceremony," he explained, following her. "Lefty bloody crap. We won 2 bloody world wars, but we're not supposed to celebrate that."
"Nonsense, Jasper," said a deep, melodious Welsh voice close at hand. "We celebrate military victories all the time. This is a different kind of celebration."
Della Wynne, the Minister for Sport, was standing just outside Chisel's door, holding the leash of her near-white Labrador. A woman of stately appearance, with grey hair swept back off a broad forehead, she wore sunglasses so dark that Robin could make out nothing behind them. Her blindness, Robin knew from her research, had been due to a rare condition in which neither eyeball had grown in utero. She sometimes wore prosthetic eyes, especially when she was to be photographed. Della was sporting a quantity of heavy, tactile jewellery in gold, with a large necklace of intaglios, and dressed from head to foot in sky blue. Robin had read in one of Strike's printed profiles of the politician that Geraint laid out Della's clothes for her every morning, and that it was simplest for him, not having a great feel for fashion, to select things in the same colour. Robin had found this rather touching when she read it. Chisel did not appear to relish the sudden appearance of his colleague, and indeed, given that her husband was blackmailing him, Robin supposed that this was hardly surprising. Della, on the other hand, gave no sign of embarrassment.
"I thought we might share the car over to Greenwich," she said to Chisel,
while the pale Labrador snuffed gently at the hem of Robin's skirt.
"Give us a chance to go over the plans for the 12th. What are you doing, Gwyn?" she added, feeling the Labrador's head tugging.
"She's sniffing me," said Robin nervously, patting the Labrador.
"This is my goddaughter,
Venetia," said Robin, as Chisel was evidently struggling to remember her name.
"How do you do?" said Della, holding out her hand. "Visiting Jasper?"
"No, I'm interning in the constituency office," said Robin, shaking the warm, beringed hand, as Chisel walked away to examine the document held by a hovering young man in a suit.
"Venetia," repeated Della,
her face still turned towards Robin. A faint frown appeared on the handsome face, half-masked behind the impenetrable black glasses.
"What's your surname?"
"Hall," said Robin. She felt a ridiculous flutter of panic, as though Della were about to unmask her. Still poring over the document he had been shown, Chisel moved away, leaving Robin, or so it felt, entirely at Della's mercy.
"You are the fencer," said Della.
"Sorry," said Robin, totally confused again, her mind on posts and rails. Some of the young people around the space-age coffee machine had turned around to listen, expressions of polite interest on their faces.
"Yes," said Della. "Yes, I remember you. You were on the English team with Freddy."
Her friendly expression had hardened. Chisel was now leaning over a desk while he struck through phrases on the document.
"No, I never fenced," said Robin,
thoroughly out of her depth. She had realized at the mention of the word team that swords were under discussion, rather than fields and livestock.
"You certainly did," said Della flatly. "I remember you. Jasper's goddaughter on the team with Freddy."
It was a slightly unnerving display of arrogance, of complete self-belief. Robin felt inadequate to the job of continuing to protest, because there were now several listeners. Instead, she merely said,
"Well, nice to have met you,"
and walked away.
"Again, you mean?" said Della sharply.
But Robin made no reply. Chapter 16. A man with as dirty a record as his. This is the sort of man that poses as a leader of the people, and successfully too. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmer's Home. After 4.5 hours in the driving seat, Strike's exit from the BMW in Manchester was far from graceful. He stood for a while in Burton Road, a broad, pleasant street with its mixture of shops and houses, leaning on the car, stretching his back and leg, grateful that he had managed to find a parking space only a short way from Stiles. The bright pink shop front stood out between a cafe and a Tesco Express, pictures of moody models with unnaturally tinted hair in the window. With its black and white tiled floor and pink walls that reminded Strike of Lorelei's bedroom, the interior of the small shop was determinedly trendy, but it did not appear to cater to a particularly youthful or adventurous clientele. There were currently only 2 clients, one of whom was a large woman of at least 60, who was reading Good Housekeeping in front of a mirror, her hair a mass of foil. Strike made a bet with himself, as he entered, that Dawn would prove to be the slim peroxide blonde with her back to him, chatting animatedly to an elderly lady whose blue hair she was perming.
"I've got an appointment with Dawn," Strike told the young receptionist, who looked slightly startled to see anything so large and male in this fug of perfumed ammonia.
The peroxided blonde turned at the sound of her name. She had the leathery, age-spotted skin of a committed sunbed user.
"With you in a moment, Cock," she said, smiling.
He settled to wait on a bench in the window. 5 minutes later, she was leading him to an upholstered pink chair at the back of the shop.
"What are you after, then?"
she asked him, inviting him with a gesture to sit down.
"I'm not here for a haircut," said Strike, still standing. I'll happily pay for one. I don't want to waste your time, but...
He pulled a card and his driver's license from his pocket.
My name's Cormoran Strike. I'm a private detective, and I was hoping to talk to you about your ex-husband, Jimmy Knight.
She looked stunned, as well she might, but then fascinated.
Strike?
She repeated, gaping.
You aren't him that caught that Ripper guy?
That's me.
Jesus, what's Jimmy done?
Nothing much, said Strike easily. I'm just after background.
She didn't believe him, of course. Her face, he suspected, was full of filler, her forehead suspiciously smooth and shiny above the carefully penciled eyebrows. Only her stringy neck betrayed her age.
That's over. It was over ages ago. I never talk about Jimmy. Least said, soonest mended, don't they say?
But he could feel the curiosity and excitement radiating from her like heat. Radio 2 jangled in the background. She glanced towards the two women sitting at the mirrors.
Shan,
she said loudly, and the receptionist jumped and turned.
Take out her foils and keep an eye on the perm for me, love.
She hesitated, still holding Strike's card.
I'm not sure I should,
she said, wanting to be talked into it.
It's only background, he said. No strings.
5 minutes later, she was handing him a milky coffee in a tiny staff room at the rear of the shop, talking merrily, a little haggard in the fluorescent overhead light, but still good-looking enough to explain why Jimmy had first shown interest in a woman 13 years his senior.
Yeah, a demonstration against nuclear weapons. I went with this friend of mine, Wendy. She was big into all that. Vegetarian,
she added, nudging the door into the shop closed with her foot and taking out a pack of silk cut.
You know the type.
Got me on, said Strike, when she offered the pack.
He lit her cigarette for her, then one of his Benson and Hedges. They blew out simultaneous streams of smoke. She crossed her legs towards him and rattled on.
Yeah, so Jimmy gave a speech, weapons and how much we could save, give to the NHS and everything. What was the point? He talks well, you know,
said Dawn.
He does, agreed Strike. I've heard him.
Yeah, and I fell for it hook, line and sinker. Thought he was some kind of Robin Hood.
Strike heard the joke coming before she made it. He knew it was not the first time.
Robin Hood, more like, she said.
She was already divorced when she had met Jimmy. Her first husband had left her for another girl at the London salon they had owned together. Dawn had done well out of the divorce, managing to retain the business. Jimmy had seemed a romantic figure after her wide boy first husband, and on the rebound, she had fallen for him hard.
But there were always girls, she said, lefties, you know. Some of them were really young. He was like a pop star to them or something. I only found out how many of them there were later, after he'd set up cards on all my accounts.
Dawn told Strike at length how Jimmy had persuaded her to bankroll a lawsuit against his ex-employer, Zanet Industries, who had failed to follow due process in firing him.
Very keen on his rights, Jimmy. He's not stupid, though, you know. 10 grand payout he got from Zanet. I never saw a penny of it. He pissed it all away, trying to sue other people. He tried to take me to court after we split up. Loss of earnings. Don't make me laugh. I'd kept him for 5 years, and he'd claimed he'd been working with me, building up the business for no pay, and left with occupational asthma from the chemicals. So much shit he talked. They chucked it out of court, thank God. And then he tried to get me on a harassment charge, said I keyed his car.
She ground out her cigarette and reached for another one.
I had two, she said,
with a sudden wicked smile.
You know he's been put on a list now. Can't sue anyone without permission.
I did know, yeah, said Strike.
Was he ever involved in any criminal activity while you were together, Dawn?
She lit up again, watching Strike over her fingers, still hoping to hear what Jimmy was supposed to have done to have Strike after him. Finally, she said,
I'm not sure he was too careful about checking all the girls he was playing around with were 16. I heard after, one of them, but we split up by then. It wasn't my problem anymore, said Dawn,
as Strike made a note.
And I wouldn't trust him if it was anything to do with Jews. He doesn't like them. Israel's the root of all evil, according to Jimmy, Zionism.
I got sick of the bloody sound of the word. You'd think they'd suffered enough, said Dawn, vaguely. Yeah, his manager at Zanet was Jewish, and they hated each other.
What was his name?
What was it?
Dawn drew heavily on her cigarette, frowning.
Paul something? Lobstein, that's it, Paul Lobstein. He's probably still at Zanet.
Do you still have any contact with Jimmy or any of his family?
Christ, no, good riddance. The only one of his family I ever met was little Billy, his brother.
She softened a little as she said the name.
He wasn't right. He stayed with us for a bit at one point. He was a sweetheart, really, but not right. Jimmy said it was their father, violent Alki. Raised them on his own and knocked the shit out of them, from what the boys said. Used a belt and everything. Jimmy got away to London and poor little Billy was left alone with him. No surprise, he was how he was.
What do you mean?
He had a tick, do they call it?
She mimicked with perfect accuracy the nose-to-chest tapping Strike had witnessed in his office.
He was put on drugs and all that. Then he left us, went to share a flat with some other lads for a bit. I never saw him again after Jimmy and I split. He was a sweet boy, yeah, but he annoyed Jimmy.
In what way? Strike asked.
Jimmy didn't like him talking about their childhood. I don't know, I think Jimmy felt guilty he'd left Billy in the house alone. There was something funny about that whole business.
Strike could tell she hadn't thought about these things for a while.
Funny? He prompted.
A couple of times, when he'd had a few, Jimmy went on about how his dad would burn for how he made his living.
I thought he was an odd job man.
Was he? They told me he was a joiner. He worked for that politician's family, what's his name? The one with the hair.
She mimed stiff bristles coming out of her head.
Jasper Chiswell,
Strike suggested, pronouncing the name the way it was spelled.
Him, yeah. Old Mr. Knight had a rent-free cottage in the family grounds. The boys grew up there.
And he said his father would go to hell for what he did for a living, repeated Strike.
Yeah, it's probably just because he was working for Tories. It was all about politics with Jimmy. I don't get it, said Dawn restlessly. You've got to live. Imagine me asking my clients how they vote before I'll... Bloody hell,
she gasped suddenly, grinding out her cigarette and jumping to her feet.
Sean had better have taken out Mrs. Orridge's rollers or she'll be bald.
Chapter 17 I see he is altogether incorrigible. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Watching for an opportunity to plant the bug in Wynne's office, Robin spent most of the afternoon hanging around the quiet corridor on which both his and Izzy's offices lay, but her efforts were fruitless. Even though Wynne had left for a lunchtime meeting, Amir remained inside. Robin paced up and down, box file in her arms, waiting for the moment when Amir might go to the bathroom and returning to Izzy's office whenever any passer-by tried to engage her in conversation. Finally, at 4:10, her luck changed. Geraint Wynne swaggered around the corner, rather tipsy after what seemed to have been a prolonged lunch, and in sharp contrast to his wife, he seemed delighted to meet her as she set off towards him.
"There she is," he said over loudly. "I wanted a word with you. Come in here. Come in."
He pushed open the door of his office. Puzzled, but only too eager to see the interior of the room she was hoping to bug, Robin followed him. Amir was working in shirt sleeves at his desk, which formed a tiny oasis of order in the general clutter. Stacks of folders lay around Wynne's desk. Robin noticed the orange logo of the level playing field on a pile of letters in front of him. There was a PowerPoint directly under Geraint's desk that would be an ideal position for the listening device.
"Have you two met?"
Geraint asked jovially.
"Venetia, Amir."
He sat down and invited Robin to take the armchair on which a sliding pile of card folders lay.
"Did Redgrave call back?"
Wynne asked Amir, struggling out of his suit jacket. "Who?" said the latter.
"Sir Steve Redgrave,"
said Wynne, with the suspicion of an eye-roll in Robin's direction. She felt embarrassed for him,
especially as Amir's muttered no was cold.
"Level playing field," Wynne told Robin.
He had managed to get his jacket off. With an attempted flourish, he threw it onto the back of his chair. It slid limply onto the floor, but Geraint appeared not to notice, and instead tapped the orange logo on the topmost letter in front of him.
"Our he belched. "Pardon me. Our charity. Disadvantaged and disabled athletes, you know. Lots of high-profile supporters. Sir Steve keen to—"
He belched again.
"Pardon. Help. Well, now, I wanted to apologize for my poor wife."
He seemed to be enjoying himself hugely. Out of the corner of her eye, Robin saw Amir flick Geraint a sharp look, like the flash of a claw, swiftly retracted.
"I don't understand," said Robin.
"Gets names wrong, does it all the time. If I didn't keep an eye on her, we'd have all sorts going on. Wrong letters going out to the wrong people. She thought you were someone else. I had her on the phone over lunch, insisting you were somebody our daughter ran across years ago. Verity Pullum. Another of your godfather's godchildren. Told her straight away it wasn't you. Said I'd pass on her apologies. Silly girl she is. Very stubborn when she thinks she's right, but—"
He rolled his eyes again and tapped his forehead, the long-suffering husband of an infuriating wife.
"I managed to penetrate in the end."
"Well," said Robin carefully, "I'm glad she knows she was mistaken, because she didn't seem to like Verity very much."
"Truth to tell, Verity was a little bitch," said Wynne, still beaming.
Robin could tell he enjoyed using the word.
"Nasty to our daughter, you see."
"Oh, dear," said Robin, with a thud of dread beneath her ribs, as she remembered that Rhiannon Wynne had killed herself. "I'm sorry. How awful."
"You know,"
said Wynne, sitting down and tipping back his chair against the wall, hands behind his head,
"you seem far too sweet a girl to be associated with the Chisel family."
He was definitely a little drunk. Robin could smell faint wine dregs on his breath, and Amir threw him another of those sharp, scathing looks.
"What were you doing before this, Vinisher?"
"PR," said Robin. "But I'd like to do something more worthwhile. Politics, or maybe a charity."
"I was reading about the level playing field," she said truthfully. "It seems wonderful. You do a lot with veterans too, don't you? I saw an interview with Terry Byrne yesterday, the Paralympian cyclist."
Her attention had been caught by the fact that Byrne had the same below-the-knee amputation as Strike.
"You'll have a personal interest in veterans, of course," said Wynne.
Robin's stomach swooped and fell again.
"Sorry?"
"Freddy Chisel,"
Wynne prompted.
"Oh, yes, of course," said Robin. "Although I didn't know Freddy very well. He was a bit older than me. Obviously it was dreadful when he was killed."
"Oh, yes, awful," said Wynne, though he sounded indifferent. "Della was very much against the Iraq War, very much against it. Your Uncle Jasper was all for it, mind you."
For a moment the air seemed to thrum with Wynne's unexpressed implication that Chisel had been well served for his enthusiasm.
"Well, I don't know about that," said Robin carefully. "Uncle Jasper thought military action justified on the evidence we had at the time. Anyway," she said bravely, "nobody can accuse him of acting out of self-interest, can they? When his son had to go and fight."
"Ah, if you're going to take that line, who can argue?" said Wynne.
He raised his hands in mock surrender. His chair slipped a little on the wall, and for a few seconds he struggled to maintain balance, seizing the desk and pulling himself and the chair upright again. With a substantial effort, Robin managed not to laugh.
"Geraint," said Amir, "we need those letters signed if we're going to get them off by 5.
"It's only half 4,
said Wynne, checking his watch.
"Yes, Rhiannon was on the British junior fencing team."
"How marvellous," said Robin.
"Sporty like her mother. Fencing with the Welsh juniors at 14. I used to drive her all over the place for tournaments. Hours on the road together. She made the British juniors at 16. But the English lot were very standoffish to her, said Wynne, with a glimmer of Celtic resentment. She wasn't one of your big public schools, you see. It was all about connections with them. Verity Pullum, she didn't have the ability, not really. As a matter of fact, it was only when Verity broke her ankle that Rhiannon, who was a far better fencer, got on the British team at all.
I see, said Robin, trying to balance sympathy with a feigned allegiance to the Chisels. Surely this could not be the grievance that Wynne had against the family. Yet Geraint's frantic tone spoke of long-standing resentment. Well, these things should come down to ability, of course.
That's right, said Wynne. They should. Look at this now.
He fumbled for his wallet and pulled from it an old photograph. Robin held out her hand, but Geraint, keeping a firm hold on the picture, got up clumsily, stumbled over a stack of books lying beside his chair, walked around the desk, came so close that Robin could feel his breath on her neck, and showed her the image of his daughter. Dressed in fencing garb, Rhiannon Wynne stood beaming and holding up the gold medal around her neck. She was pale and small-featured, and Robin could see very little of either parent in her face, although perhaps there was a hint of Della in the broad, intelligent brow. But with Geraint's loud breathing in her ear, trying to stop herself leaning away from him, Robin had a sudden vision of Geraint Wynne striding, with his wide, lipless grin, through a large hall of sweaty teenage girls. Was it shameful to wonder whether it had been parental devotion that had spurred him to chauffeur his daughter all over the country?
"What have you done to yourself, eh?" Geraint asked, his hot breath in her ear.
Leaning in, he touched the purple knife scar on her bare forearm. Unable to prevent herself, Robin snatched her arm away. The nerves around the scar had not yet fully healed. She hated anyone touching it. "I fell through a glass door when I was 9, she said. But the confidential, confiding atmosphere had been dispersed like cigarette smoke. Amir hovered on the edge of her vision, rigid and silent at his desk. Geraint's smile had become forced. She had worked too long in offices not to know that a subtle transfer of power had just taken place within the room. Now she stood armed with his little drunken inappropriateness, and Geraint was resentful and a little worried. She wished that she had not pulled away from him.
"I wonder, Mr. Wynne," she said breathily, "whether you'd mind giving me some advice about the charitable world. I just can't make up my mind. Politics, charity. And I don't know anyone else who's done both."
"Oh,"
said Geraint, blinking behind his thick glasses.
"Oh, well, yes, I dare say I could."
"Geraint," said Amir again, "we really do need to get those letters."
"Yes, all right," said Geraint loudly. "We'll talk later,"
he said to Robin, with a wink.
"Wonderful," she said, with a smile.
As Robin walked out, she threw Amir a small smile, which he didn't return. Chapter 18. So matters have got as far as that already, have they? Henry Gibson, Rosmersholm. After nearly 9 hours at the wheel, Strike's neck, back and legs were stiff and sore, and his bag of provisions long since empty. The first star was glimmering out of the pale inky wash above when his mobile rang. It was the usual time for his sister Lucy to call for a chat. He ignored 3 out of 4 of her calls, because much as he loved her, he could muster no interest in her son's schooling, the PTA's squabbles, or the intricacies of her husband's career as a quantity surveyor. Seeing it was Barclay on the line, however, he turned into a rough-and-ready lay-by, really the turn-off to a field, cut the engine, and answered.
"I'm in," said Barclay laconically. "With Jimmy."
"Already?" said Strike, seriously impressed.
"How?"
"Pub," said Barclay. "Interrupted him. He was talking a lot of pish about Scottish independence. The great thing about English left is," he continued, "is they love hearing how shite England is. Haven't I had to buy a pint all afternoon?"
"Bloody hell, Barclay," said Strike, lighting himself another cigarette, on top of the 20 he had already had that day. "That was good work."
"That was just for starters," said Barclay. "You should have heard them when I told them I've seen the era of the army's imperialist ways. Fuck me, they're gullible. I'm off to a corps meeting tomorrow."
"How's Knight supporting himself? Any idea?"
"He told me he's a journalist on a couple of lefty websites, and he sells core t-shirts and a bit of dope. Mind, his shit's worthless. We went back to his place after the pub. You'd be better off smoking fucking Oxo cubes. I've said I'll get him better. We can run that through office expenses, aye?"
"I'll put it under sundries," said Strike.
"All right, keep me posted."
Barclay rang off. Deciding to take the opportunity to stretch his legs, Strike got out of the car, still smoking, leaned on the 5-bar gate facing a wide, dark field, and rang Robin.
"It's Vanessa," Robin lied, when she saw Strike's number come up on her phone. She and Matthew had just eaten a takeaway curry off their knees while watching the news. He had arrived home late and tired. She didn't need another argument. Picking up the mobile, she headed out through the French doors onto the patio that had served as the smoking area for the party. After making sure that the doors were completely closed, she answered.
"Hi, everything okay?"
"Fine. All right to talk for a moment?"
"Yes," said Robin, leaning against the garden wall, and watching a moth banging fruitlessly against the bright glass, trying to enter the house.
"How did it go with Dawn Clancy?"
"Nothing usable," said Strike. "I thought I might have a lead, some Jewish ex-boss Jimmy had a vendetta against, but I ran the company and the poor bloke died of a stroke last September. Then I got a call from Chisel just after I left her. He said the son's sniffing around."
"Yes," said Robin. "They called his wife."
"We could have done without that," said Strike, with what Robin felt was considerable understatement. "I wonder who's tipped off the papers."
"I'd bet on Wynne," said Robin, remembering the way that Geraint had talked that afternoon, the name-dropping, the self-importance. "He's just the type to hint to a journalist that there's a story on Chisel, even if he hasn't got proof of it yet."
"Seriously," she said again, with no real hope of an answer. "What do you think Chisel did?"
"Be nice to know, but it doesn't really matter," said Strike, who sounded tired. "We aren't being paid to get the goods on him. Speaking of which..."
"I haven't been able to plant the bug yet," said Robin, anticipating the question. "I hung around as late as possible, but Amir locked the door after they both left."
Strike sighed.
"Well, don't get over-eager and balls it up," he said. "But we're up against it if the son's involved. Anything you can do. Get in early or something."
"I will, I'll try," said Robin. "I did get something odd about the winds today, though." And she told him about the confusion Della had made between herself and one of Chisel's real goddaughters, and the story of Rhiannon on the fencing team. Strike seemed only distantly interested.
"Doubt that explains the winds wanting Chisel out of the office. Anyway, means before motive," she said, quoting Strike's own oft-repeated words. "Exactly. Listen, can you meet me after work tomorrow and we'll have a proper debrief?"
"All right," said Robin.
"Barclay's doing good work, though," said Strike, as though the thought of it cheered him up. "He's already well in with Jimmy."
"Oh," said Robin. "Good."
After telling her that he would text the name of a convenient pub, Strike rang off, leaving Robin alone and pensive in the quiet dark of the yard, while stars grew pinbright overhead.
"Barclay's doing good work, though."
As opposed to Robin, who had found out nothing but an irrelevancy about Rhiannon Wynne. The moth was still fluttering desperately against the sliding doors, frantic to get at the light.
"Idiot," Robin thought. "It's better out here."
The ease with which the lie about Vanessa being on the phone had slid out of her mouth ought, she reflected, to have made her feel guilty. But she was merely glad that she had got away with it. As she watched the moth continuing to bang its wings hopelessly against a brilliant glass, Robin remembered what her therapist had said to her during one of the sessions when Robin had dwelled at length on her need to discern where the real Matthew ended
and her illusions about him began.
"People change in 10 years," the therapist had responded. "Why does it have to be a question of you being mistaken in Matthew? Perhaps it's simply that you've both changed." The following Monday would mark their first wedding anniversary. At Matthew's suggestion, they were going to spend next weekend at a fancy hotel near Oxford. In a funny kind of way, Robin was looking forward to it, because she and Matthew seemed to get along better these days with a change of scene. Being surrounded by strangers nudged them out of their tendency to bicker. She had told him the story of Ted Heath's bus turning green, along with several other, to her, interesting facts about the House of Commons. He had maintained a bored expression through all of them, determined to signal his disapproval of the whole venture. Reaching a decision, she opened the French window, and the moth fluttered merrily inside. "What did Vanessa want?" asked Matthew, his eyes on the news as Robin sat down again. Sarah Shadlock's stargazer lilies were sitting on a table beside her, still in bloom, 10 days after they had arrived in the house, and Robin could smell their heady scent even over the curry.
"I picked up her sunglasses by mistake last time we went out," said Robin, feigning exasperation. "She wants them back. They're Chanel. I said I'll meet her before work."
"Chanel, eh?" said Matthew, with a smile that Robin found patronizing. She knew that he thought he had discovered a weakness in Vanessa, but perhaps he liked her better to think that she valued designer labels and wanted to make sure she got them back.
"I'll have to leave at 6, said Robin.
6? He said, annoyed. "Christ, I'm knackered. I don't want to wake up at..."
"I was going to suggest I sleep in the spare room," Robin said.
"Oh," said Matthew, mollified. "Yeah, okay, thanks."
Chapter 19. I do not do it willingly, but, enfin, when needs must. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Robin left the house at 5:45 the next morning. The sky was a faint blush pink, and the morning already warm, justifying her lack of jacket. Her eyes flickered towards the single carved swan as she passed their local pub, but she forced her thoughts back onto the day ahead, and not the man she had left behind. On arrival in Izzy's corridor an hour later, Robin saw that Geraint's office door was already open. A swift peek inside showed her an empty room, but Amir's jacket hanging on the back of his chair. Running to Izzy's office, Robin unlocked it, dashed to her desk, pulled one of the listening devices from the box of Tampax, scooped up a pile of out-of-date agendas as an alibi, then ran back out into the corridor. As she approached Geraint's office, she slid off the gold bangle that she had worn for this purpose, and threw it lightly so that it rolled into Geraint's office. "Oh, damn!" she said out loud. Nobody responded from inside the office. Robin knocked on the open door, said hello, and put her head inside. The room was still empty. Robin dashed across the room to the double PowerPoint just above the skirting board beside Geraint's desk. Kneeling, she took the listening device out of her bag, unplugged the fan on his desk, pressed the device into place over the dual socket, reinserted the fan's plug, checked that it worked, then, panting as though she had just sprinted 100 yards, looked around for her bangle. "What are you doing?" Amir was standing in the doorway in his shirt sleeves, a fresh tea in his hand.
"I did knock," Robin said, sure that she was bright pink. "I dropped my bangle and it rolled. Oh, there it is."
It was lying beneath Amir's computer chair. Robin scrambled to pick it up.
"It's my mother's," she lied. "I wouldn't be popular if that went missing."
She slid the bangle back over her wrist, picked up the papers she had left on Geraint's desk, smiled as casually as she could manage, then walked out of the office past Amir, whose eyes, she saw out of the corner of her own, were narrowed in suspicion. Jubilant, Robin re-entered Izzy's office. At least she would have some good news for Strike when they met in the pub that evening. Barclay was no longer the only one doing good work. So absorbed was she in her thoughts
that Robin didn't realize that there was somebody else in the room until a man said right behind her, "Who are you?" The present dissolved. Both of her attackers had lunged at her from behind. With a scream, Robin spun around, ready to fight for her life. The papers flew into the air and a handbag slipped off her shoulder, fell to the floor and burst open, scattering its contents everywhere.
"Sorry," said the man. "Christ, I'm sorry."
But Robin was finding it hard to draw breath. There was a thundering in her ears, and sweat had broken out all over her body. She bent down to scoop everything back up, trembling so much that she kept dropping things.
"Not now. Not now."
He was talking to her, but she couldn't understand a word. The world was fragmenting again, full of terror and danger, and he was a blur as he handed her eyeliner and a bottle of drops to moisten her contact lenses.
"Oh," Robin gasped at random. "Great. Excuse me. Bathroom."
She stumbled to the door. Two people were coming towards her down the corridor, their voices fuzzy and indistinct as they greeted her. Hardly knowing what she responded, she half ran past them towards the ladies. A woman from the Secretary for Health's office greeted her from the sink where she was applying lipstick. Robin blundered blindly past, locking the cubicle door with fumbling fingers. It was no use trying to suppress the panic. That only made it fight back, trying to bend her to its will. She must ride it out, as though the fear was a bolting horse, easing it onto a more manageable course. So she stood motionless, palms pressed against the partition walls, speaking to herself inside her head, as though she were an animal handler, and her body, in its irrational terror, a frantic prey creature.
"You're safe. You're safe. You're safe."
Slowly the panic began to ebb, though her heart was still leaping erratically. At last, Robin removed her numb hands from the walls of the cubicle and opened her eyes, blinking in the harsh lights. The bathroom was quiet. Robin peered out of the cubicle. The woman had left. There was nobody there except her own pale reflection in the mirror. After splashing cold water on her face and patting it dry with paper towels, she readjusted her clear-lensed glasses and left the bathroom. An argument seemed to be in progress in the office she had just left. Taking a deep breath, she re-entered the room. Jasper Chisel turned to glare at her, his wiry mass of grey hair sticking out around his pink face. Izzy was standing behind her desk. The stranger was still there. In her shaken state, Robin would have preferred not to be the focus of three pairs of curious eyes.
"What just happened?" Chisel demanded of Robin.
"Nothing," said Robin,
feeling cold sweat erupting again under her dress.
"You ran out of the room. Did he,"
Chisel pointed at the dark man,
"do something to you? Make a pass?"
"What? No. I didn't realize he was in here, that's all. He spoke and I jumped. And—"
she could feel herself blushing harder than ever.
"Then I needed the loo."
Chisel rounded on the dark man.
"So why are you here so early, eh?"
Now at last Robin realized that this was Raphael. She had known from the pictures she had found online that this half-Italian was an exotic in a family that was otherwise uniformly blonde and very English in appearance, but had been wholly unprepared for how handsome he was in the flesh. His charcoal grey suit, white shirt, and a conventional dark blue spotted tie were worn with an air that none of the other men along the corridor could muster. So dark-skinned as to appear swarthy, he had high cheekbones, almost black eyes, dark hair wore long and floppy, and a wide mouth that, unlike his father's, had a full upper lip that added vulnerability to his face.
"I thought you liked punctuality, Dad," he said,
raising his arms and letting them fall in a slightly hopeless gesture. His father turned to Izzy.
"Give him something to do."
Chisel marched out. Mortified, Robin headed for her desk. Nobody spoke until Chisel's footsteps had died away. Then Izzy spoke.
He's under all kinds of stress just now, Raff Babes. It isn't you. He's honestly going berserk about the smallest things.
I'm so sorry, Robin forced herself to say to Raphael. I completely overreacted.
No problem, he replied, in the kind of accent that is routinely described as public school. For the record, I'm not, in fact, a sex offender.
Robin laughed nervously.
You're the goddaughter I didn't know about. Nobody tells me anything. Venetia, yeah? I'm Raff.
Yes. Hi.
They shook hands and Robin retook her seat, busying herself with some pointless paper shuffling. She could feel her colour fluctuating.
It's just crazy at the moment, Izzy said,
and Robin knew that she was trying, for not entirely unselfish reasons, to persuade Raphael that their father wasn't as bad to work with as he might appear.
We're understaffed. We've got the Olympics coming up. TTS is constantly going off on Papa.
What's going off on him?
Asked Raphael, dropping down into the sagging armchair, loosening his tie and crossing his long legs.
TTS, Izzy repeated. Lean over and put the kettle on while you're there, Raff. I'm dying for coffee. TTS. It stands for Tinky the Second. It's what Fizz and I call Kinvara.
The many nicknames of the Chisel family had been explained to Robin during her office interludes with Izzy. Izzy's older sister, Sophia, was Fizzy, while Sophia's three children rejoiced in the pet names of Pringle, Flopsy, and Pong.
"Why Tinky the Second?"
asked Raff, unscrewing a jar of instant coffee with long fingers. Robin was still very aware of all his movements, though keeping her eyes on her supposed work.
"What was Tinky the First?"
"Oh, come on, Raff. You must have heard about Tinky," said Izzy. "That ghastly Australian nurse Grampy married last time round when he was getting senile. He blew most of the money on her. He was the second silly old codger she'd married. Grampy bought her a dud racehorse and a load of horrible jewellery. Papa nearly had to go to court to get her out of the house when Grampy died. She dropped dead of breast cancer before it got really expensive, thank God."
Startled by this sudden callousness, Robin looked up.
"How do you take it, Venetia?"
Raphael asked, as he spooned coffee into mugs.
"Why, no sugar, please," said Robin.
She thought it best if she maintained a low profile for a while, after her recent incursion into Wynne's office.
"TTS married Papa for his dosh," Izzy ploughed on. "And she's horse-mad like Tinky. You know she's got 9 now. 9!"
"9 what?" said Raphael.
"Horses, Raff," said Izzy impatiently. "Bloody uncontrollable bad man at hot-blooded horses that she mollycoddles and keeps as child substitutes and spends all the money on. God, I wish Papa would leave her," said Izzy. "Pass the biscuit tin, babes."
He did so. Robin, who could feel him looking at her, maintained a pretense of absorption in her work. The telephone rang.
"Jasper Chisel's office," said Izzy,
trying to prise the lid off the biscuit tin one-handed, the receiver under her chin.
"Oh," she said, suddenly cool. "Hello, Kinvara. You've just missed Papa."
Grinning at his half-sister's expression, Raphael took the biscuits from her, opened them, and offered the tin to Robin, who shook her head. A torrent of indistinguishable words was pouring from Izzy's earpiece.
"No, no, he's gone. He only came over to say hello to Raff."
The voice at the end of the phone seemed to become more strident.
"Back at DCMS. He's got a meeting at 10, said Izzy. "I can't. Well, because he's very busy, you know, the Olymp... Yes, goodbye."
Izzy slammed the receiver down and struggled out of her jacket. She should take another rest cure. The last one doesn't seem to have done her much good.
"Izzy doesn't believe in mental illness," Raphael told Robin.
He was contemplating her, still slightly curious and, she guessed, trying to draw her out.
"Of course I believe in mental illness, Raff," said Izzy, apparently stung. "Of course I do. I was sorry for her when it happened. I was, Raff.
Kinvara had a stillbirth 2 years ago," Izzy explained.
"And of course that's sad. Of course it is. And it was quite understandable that she was a bit, you know, afterwards. But no, I'm sorry," she said crossly, addressing Raphael. "But she uses it. She does, Raff.
She thinks it entitles her to everything she wants, and, well, she'd have been a dreadful mother anyway, said Izzy defiantly. She can't stand not being the centre of attention.